about to talk about a film full of agonizing choices, but I can tell you about one choice that's easy to make. The choice to switch to Spark Plug Coffee. If you love coffee, you know that fresh roasted beans really make the difference between a good cup of coffee and the best cup of coffee. But fresh roasted beans can be pretty hard to get your hands on, or they were, until now. SparkPlugCoffee.com is a service that delivers fresh coffee beans right to your door within a week of being roasted. Whole bean or ground, anywhere in Canada, and good news for our American listeners, soon to be available in the US too.
Coming soon.
They offer a consistently great product with several blends to cater to any taste from the mild to dark, and even half-calf so you can drink twice as much. Put your order on autopilot, a set-it-and-forget-it regular delivery so that you'll never run out of coffee again. It's time for your favorite cup of coffee to start coming from your own kitchen. So plug yourself in at sparkplugcoffee.com.
Top 100.
Top 100.
Top 100.
Project.
And action.
Greetings, folks. Thanks for tuning in to the Top 106 Project, our look back at the American Film Institute's 1998 and 2007 Top 100 lists continues. Spoiler alert, we intend to destroy the twists and turns of this picture. I am Ryan Ellis with the woman who, gun to her head, just might choose her dogs over her husband, my wife Bev.
That's me.
Who can blame her? Okay, the coming attractions trivia for this week's picture, Sophie's Choice. There are 18 films left on the Top 100 Project, including Sophie's Choice. After Sophie's Choice, what are the other two that didn't score a nomination for the Best Picture Oscar?
I thought that maybe it was just Toy Story, but it's Toy Story and Do the Right Thing.
You got them.
I thought Do the Right Thing was nominated for Best Picture. It really should have been. It got the token screenplay and Danny Aiello for Supporting Actor. Mm-hmm. But it didn't get nominated for Best Picture.
And 89 was a pretty good year. I liked a lot of the movies that came out that year, but it should have been in the top five. And it made the list, and no other film from 89 did.
And Toy Story also. Toy Story definitely should have been nominated for Best Picture.
Another good year for me, at least. 1995 is one of my favorite years of the 90s. Nice little promotion for two movies, and we've talked about Do the Right Thing a few times lately in these coming attraction trivia questions. We keep on building up to where we're going to get to, not that far away. So, the Top 100 Project's 106th movie, Sophie's Choice, was not on AFI's 1998 Top 100, despite being amongst the 400 nominees, then made it to 91st place in 2007 between one of Bev's absolute favorites, maybe number one on her list, Swing Time, not even close to her list, and Goodfellas, a movie that maybe is somewhat close to her number one spot. Sophie's Choice was premiered by Universal on December 8th, 1982. Then they put it out there for everyone on March 4th, 1983. But we do think of it as a 1982 film, our fourth and final of this year. Nothing actually from 1983 made the list. The movie was a modest success at the box office. Bev will describe it for you now with her skinny.
Peter McNichol is aspiring writer Stingo, who moves from the South to an apartment in post-war Brooklyn. He befriends his neighbors, Sophie and Nathan, who are in love, despite Nathan's dangerously erratic behavior, and they're both harboring some disturbing secrets. Nathan is played by Kevin Kline, and Sophie is, of course, played by Meryl Streep.
Or, in a nutshell, always pick the boy. Oh. My most sexist nutshell of all time. And a spoiler alert right near the beginning of the podcast. Alright, so the numbers on the movie, there aren't that many of them. The Rotten Tomatoes critics, first of all, 79% of those liked it, 22 fresh, 6 rotten, and 85% of audiences. Those are fairly weak scores by our recent times. The 70s, of course, generally had strong scores. And there's no real box office numbers to talk about. I'm going to say this before I even ask Bev's opinion. This movie has none of the criteria to make this list, other than Streep's performance, which is one of the legendary ones of all time, and it certainly has made her fame. She would have been famous anyway, but this is probably her crowning achievement. But it doesn't have the influence, it didn't make that much money, it won only this one award in any major way, at least at the Oscars. Like the movie? Not an AFI film. But your turn, go.
Well, there's really nothing innovative or groundbreaking about the movie, and it has its share of problems, like a rather boring protagonist and some draggy parts. I still liked it a lot, and it got to me. I cared about them, Sophie and Nathan in particular. I felt the insight into the aftermath of this overwhelming trauma. As much as it treads very familiar ground, I feel like it had something new to say about life after wartime. And even though I've had that very famous scene about Sophie making her choice meticulously described to me and fully spoiled, it still totally did a number
on
me.
It should have.
Yeah. So I really like this movie, but I agree with you. It shouldn't be on the list at all. It is a good movie. It is a great performance, but it is not a great movie. Worth watching. I would recommend it for sure.
Roger Ebert picked it as his favorite movie of 1982, for what that's worth. Okay, well, we've already set the tone for what we think of the movie making the list. Usually we say that at the end. So let's get into the story itself. So it is set in Brooklyn in 1947, just after WW2. This is the first post-World War II film since The Godfather, which was 21 AFI movies ago. It's a theme we've had either during the war or just after it. And we're going to get into the World War II with Saving Private Ryan, and then also Vietnam, a whole different era, obviously, Platoon and Forrest Gump and some other films that involve that. But Sophie's Choice is the complete opposite of the effects-driven, high-concept movies we've had lately. E.T., Raiders of the Lost Ark, Blade Runner, Star Wars wasn't that long ago, Close Encounters of the Third Kind, Apocalypse Now. It's essentially a three-person story. There aren't that many other actors really need to talk about other than the three we mentioned in The Skinny. And the wartime flashbacks are the reason for the story to exist. Were it not for those, and it was just about the 1947 storyline, it'd be interesting enough. But the movie would have meant nothing. It is all about her choice, it's all about her experience, and we don't even learn about that choice till the end of the movie, when she finally confesses to Stinga what really happened. And one of the influences of this film, there aren't a lot of them, but I thought of this one during the film, Almost Famous. So spoiler alert for Almost Famous, and if you haven't seen that movie by now, you really should have. One of my favorites of the 2000s. Penny Lane tries to kill herself, and that movie's an homage to The Apartment. Shirley MacLaine does the same thing. Jack Lemmon is her William Miller. And then Penny confesses to William Miller what her real name is. Do you remember what the name is?
No.
Lady Goodman. And then later in the film, Russell Hammond, the Billy Crudup character, says, I never knew her real name. And William has a little bit of a smile on his face. Oh, I knew. You were the one sleeping with her, and I never got to that point, and I was always the friend, but I knew that little secret. Stingo is William Miller in this film, and then Kevin Kline's character is the Billy Crudup character. He's the one sleeping with her. He was in love with her. They were connected. They did all these things together. But the friend is the one who knew the most important thing. Well, in the case of Sophie, the most important thing, and one of the more important things with Penny Lane.
I feel like this particular variety of love triangle is a common trope.
Yep.
It actually reminded me of The Great Gatsby.
Yeah, right. That
because
too.
You have a writer who moves to New York from somewhere else, who becomes enamored with both members of a troubled, doomed couple.
Mm-hmm.
The character of Stingo reminded me a lot of, what's his name?
Tobey Maguire plays him. I forget his name.
Yeah,
now,
I know.
Too. We like the movie, too. We forget the name of the character. But Gatsby is DiCaprio, and Carey Mulligan is Daisy. And Gatsby came before the William Styron novel, which he wrote in 1979. He dealt with depression a lot in his life, and there's no doubt that Sophie and Nathan have issues with that, too. Before we get into Miss Streep, because she is the best thing in this film, and obviously the reason why it's on the list, but Kevin Kline has never given enough credit for how good he is in this film. He wasn't nominated for any major awards, certainly not the Oscar anyway. This movie is what got him A Fish Called Wanda, the polar opposite character, where he plays a comedic moron, but he plays the paranoid schizophrenic. I called him bipolar in last week's podcast, but I think it's kind of the same thing.
It's not the same thing. The main difference between schizophrenia and bipolar is that with bipolar, the patient gets breaks from their delusions. They go up and down, ebbs and tides.
He does that.
Then that's an inaccurate portrayal of schizophrenia. But he always believes that he's a Nobel Prize contending scientist.
But he's often up the way that bipolar people are at least are portrayed in TV and movies. I mean, really up. And
well,
when he's down,
I mean,
he's really down.
I can't defend what the writer or the filmmakers knew or didn't know about schizophrenia. And another thing about schizophrenia is it presents differently in every person, just like bipolar disorder too. But they describe him as paranoid schizophrenic, and it is a different disorder from bipolar disorder.
Okay, well then fair enough. Let's get past that medical point. But the character himself, waiting for Nathan to blow up is like waiting for Freddy Krueger to show up. Because every time that they think things are good, something's happened, they want to celebrate the book that Stingo's writing or something like that. He comes home in one of those moods, and because I've seen the movie before, and because I've seen any movie before, you know, this is the setup for something bad to happen. The movie's kind of cliche in that way. Maybe it beat other movies to the punch in doing that. But it's almost always when Sophie and Stingo are happy about something and ready to party, Mr. Party Time is the opposite, and he wants to say cutting, horrible, mean things.
I wonder if part of the reason why Sophie stays with him is because she hates herself so much and there's some catharsis in the punishment that he doles out to her. She doesn't deserve what he's saying to her, but what he's saying to her hits the nerve that she needs to hit. he's accusing her of almost collaborating with Nazis. He straight up tells her she should feel bad about surviving, which is exactly how she does feel. She has this extreme acute survivor's guilt. Every person that she knew back in Poland was dead, no matter what, whether they were Jewish or whether they were Nazis. They all died, including her children. It's absolutely heartbreaking, so why should she live? And she did some pretty despicable things to try to save herself and try to save her children. Mm-hmm. Some unethical steps that she took, whether it was refusing to help the resistance, using sex to curry favor with the officer. Mm-hmm.
Helping her father with his pro-Nazi propaganda.
Yeah, and constantly trying to take advantage of her status as a non-Jew. Mm-hmm. She would always remind the officers, look, I'm not Jewish.
During the choice scene, Catholic. She brings it up very clearly. Yeah. That doesn't matter. And the thing about that scene, okay, let's talk about it now. That's so memorable. We just said the word collaborator. That Nazi officer, when he makes her make the choice, makes her a collaborator in a way with him. Which one's going to live, which one's going to die? You got to choose. So it's bad enough that anybody's got to die in that scene. Why do that in the first place? Maybe because she doesn't do exactly what he wants. He just wants to be a bully and
he's
a jerk.
He's just toying with her, maybe.
And a horrible piece of crap. He might as well not even be human. But it's also probably deliberate to make her, as long as she's going to live, and he probably thinks she won't live long anyway, that she's got to live with the fact that she sent one of her kids off to die and had to choose right then and there. And as I said, in the nutshell, she does choose the boy.
A lot of people have disputed why she would choose the boy over the girl. To me, it seems obvious that just the boy had way better shot of surviving. Mm-hmm. He was older, he was a boy, so he might have been some use in the work camps. Whereas the girl, she was 4 years old. She wasn't going to last long no matter what happened. Apparently, there's a passage in the book where Sophie rationalizes her choice, where she says, you know, I had to make this split-second decision, and in that short time, said that her daughter was holding a teddy bear, and her son had nothing, and she thought, well, I let her go because she still can keep the teddy bear, she'll still have some comfort, whereas if I let my son go, he'll have nothing, so I have to stay with him because he doesn't have a teddy bear. And I thought that was such a beautiful, succinct expression of how we sometimes make those impossible split-second decisions. And in a way, it absolves that thinking, actually rationally trying to decide which child should live or die. It was more like, I don't know, I'm just going to latch on to this one random detail that will help me pick somebody because I have to make a decision or they're both going to die.
I like that. I hadn't read that. That's an interesting tidbit of information. But just based on what's in the movie, and we don't know why she chooses, you said the word split second. That's what it comes down to. Mm-hmm. He makes her choose. This isn't a matter of when I come back in 5 minutes, you got to pick somebody. It's right now or they're both dead.
Yeah, she's trying to refuse to cooperate until the very last minute when she knows that it's one or both of them. She feels so terrible and so guilty mm-hmm. for this action when anybody watching that scene knows she didn't have a choice. In the end, both her children are probably dead. We don't really know what happened to her
they
son.
Are, no, they are dead.
Oh, do we learn that he's
that's the whole
dead?
Thing. All of her family died during the occupation, the prison camps, the war, all of it.
But we never actually learn what happened to Jan, her son. Kind of like Dr. Zhivago, where Laura disappears and we never learn what happened to her and they know that she's probably dead. Same goes where she never learned what happened to Jan.
I thought they said that he was dead.
She said she never found out what happened to him.
Well, then in effect, he is dead.
And that ambiguity is what happens in war, and that agony of never even knowing what happened.
Sure. Whether your family members who aren't even actually in the war, if you're a soldier and your buddy is gone, you don't know if he's been killed. That's part of the tragedy of the thing. And the guy makes her make this choice and puts it on her for the rest of her life, probably knowing they're both going to die in one way or another anyway.
Mm-hmm. He is a cartoonishly cruel character. I think Hollywood has this habit of overdoing the evil Nazi, just making them inhuman.
I'm not sure he's cartoonish. I think that he's very matter-of-fact. We've seen that in movies like The Pianist and, of course, Schindler's List. The only movie now left you have not seen on the list. You hadn't seen this one. So it's the two Holocaust films for the last little while. You'd seen so many in the 70s. When we started the project, you hadn't seen about half the movies. So
yeah,
the one left
that's
now
right.
We've not seen. But both Sophie's Choice and Schindler's List and The Pianist, which isn't an AFI nominee at all, and not even an American film, they all have sequences, more so Schindler's than The Pianist, where it's a matter-of-fact kind of violence. Somebody speaks out in The Pianist, he's just shot dead. The friend I went to the movie with jumped in his seat, literally, when the guy got shot in the head. I actually kind of saw it coming, because I knew that that's the way that these kind of movies portray the Nazis. Matter-of-factly just killing these non-people, at least to them, they're not people.
But it's not matter-of-fact to make a mother choose between her two children.
Well, that's him just toying with her.
Exactly. That's not matter-of-fact, that's
and
evil.
I don't think that makes him cartoonish. I think that makes him, at least in Hollywood's portrayal of Nazis, the way they were. The most key moment in that whole sequence, I don't remember where I saw this, it may have been the AFI special, the second one in 2007, but somebody, maybe it was Meryl Streep, talks about how when they cut from the daughter being dragged away and screaming her head up, as of course she would, they cut back to Sophie in a close-up. Her mouth is wide open. She's not making any noise. It's one of those silent screams. But we hear the daughter scream.
Mm-hmm.
It's just ripping your guts out. And it affected you. It affected me, too. You told me as much when the movie was over how much of that scene got you. And, of course, it's supposed to. That's the whole point of the movie. That's the name of the movie.
It's incredibly raw and powerful. Yeah, I knew exactly what was coming, but it still absolutely tore me apart. Her performance is great, but that moment right there, apparently they did 13 takes.
I heard it was one take.
Well, I read an interview with the girl who played the daughter. And what the director, Alan J. Pakula, did was he had both those kids on set for a solid month before they started shooting so that Streep could spend time with them every single day and actually develop a bond and a relationship with them. The girl who played her daughter, Jennifer Lawn, she was 4 when she got cast. She said that she actually did have this great relationship with Meryl Streep. Streep's performance was so convincing that it would genuinely upset her every time, and you can see her face in the whole scene, how upset she is. She said that she was terrified of the officer, the actor who played the officer. Yeah. When she got pulled away from Streep, those screams were genuine, and then they did that take 13 more times.
I read it as one take, and that Meryl wasn't going to do another one. Maybe it was that one close-up of her, with that frozen scream. Maybe that was what it was.
And apparently she opted not to audibly scream so that the audio guys could pick up Lejeune's scream because it was so moving and intense. And I guess Streep thought if they decide that they want me to scream, I can always pick that up in ADR. But they were never going to get that performance from 4-year-old girl.
It reminds me, we talked about in the Godfather movies, that in the third one, spoiler alert for Godfather Part 3, that when Michael's daughter dies, he has a scream like that where they play music. And they cut it out. And there's two reasons why. One was an artistic statement, where you have him screaming, but there's just music playing. The same music from Raging Bull, Cavalleria Rusticana, I believe is what it's called. But then after the big breath Pacino takes, then you do hear him go, ah! And they said the part they cut out was too much.
Yeah, too guttural, too emotional.
It was almost too powerful, even though it's such a powerful moment.
Mm-hmm.
So maybe that was homaging Sophie's Choice.
So when we talk about Sophie's Choice, it's the driving force behind her guilt and her self-loathing. The whole movie is about all the choices she makes. It's about her choice between Nathan and Stingo, her choice to lie about her father, her choice not to translate German documents for the freedom fighters. It's her choice to steal the radio or not, her choice ultimately to live or die.
It's also Sophie's choice to pick death with Nathan over life with Stingo.
Yeah.
Because at the end, she's run away from Nathan. He's never going to find her. And maybe he wouldn't even try to in the first place. But she deliberately goes back there. Maybe she doesn't know that they're going to end up dead. All right, trivia question. How do they kill themselves?
They take cyanide.
That's right. This woman clearly had a very hard life. She has anemia when she gets to America and passes out. She was suicidal. We see the scars in her arms where she tried to kill herself. We said her father was a Nazi sympathizer, and her whole family ends up dead before and during World War II. She has PTSD. You don't have to be a soldier to deal with PTSD, and this movie proves that point very clearly. As we said, she's a Catholic Pole who's rounded up just because. I guess she's an intellectual. They rounded up a lot of them, too, no matter whether they were Jews or not.
Well, I guess we're meant to presume that the ham story is true. That she stole a ham, and
right,
that's how she got
picked
up. Right,
that's true. I forgot about the ham thing. That's right. Another excuse, though.
Yeah.
And as bad as the Nazis were, and as much as they are red-letter villains in movies for sure, but even in the world, I don't think there's much doubt there are plenty of bad guys in the history of the world that have gone to these kinds of lengths of extermination of people that pick whatever reason they want to say, you're going to, even if they weren't originally in that group of people that were going to die.
Like one of the soldiers says, it doesn't matter if you're Jewish or not, you're Polish, and therefore you are our enemy, and therefore you have to be eliminated.
And Poland was what got ruined country-wise first.
Yeah.
Before the war even really got going. But let's get back into the 1947 present of the movie a little bit more. The love triangle is a la Butch and Sundance from Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid.
Yeah.
Stingo is Butch to Nathan Sundance because there's a platonic situation going on there. But in Butch and Sundance, Etta even asks him, why didn't we end up together, Butch? And the suggestion is he's in love with her to a point, but he's never going to cross the line. Stingo is clearly in love with Sophie the whole time. He's also a young kid in lust with everybody, as he says blatantly in the voiceover. Joseph Sommer, who had a role in Close Encounters of the Third Kind and has had a long career in Hollywood. He was in tons of movies. His voiceover narration, we talked about Goodfellas, it was around that on the second list. Probably the best narration of all time, one of at least in the history of movies. Sophie's Choice is one of those that doesn't need to be there. When it says that Stingo, and of course Joseph Sommer's character is an older version of Stingo, that he's in lust with everybody, he wants all this kind of... We can see all of it. I don't know if any of it really helps. It maybe sets the scene a little bit, but it doesn't need to be there.
And he is just as in love with
Nathan
as he is with Sophie.
They both seduce him.
Yeah, they really do. Nathan, like you talked earlier about Kevin Kline's performance. the best thing about his performance is that you believe that he's mentally ill. Yep. You believe that he's delusional and there's something seriously, tragically wrong with him and that their relationship is toxic. But he still conveys that charisma so convincingly that in that moment when his brother tells Stingo just how sick he really is and that he's not really a biologist and all the lies that he's been telling and the delusions that he believes himself, and Stingo still loves him, you totally understand, you're totally on his side, and you believe that if you were in that situation, you also would still like him just the same.
The movie shows why women take so much abuse but stick it out because of the tenderness, because of the charisma, because of the fact that he can be loving and nice. He's obviously a good lover, at least he's an enthusiastic lover. And then Stingo gets to enjoy this charismatic guy who's introducing him to literature and music, and he's crazy and he's fun, and he celebrates the book that Stingo's written, which maybe is tripe, because later on when Nathan's having one of his downtimes, he actually says it is crap.
Yeah. I think infatuation with somebody who's struggling with a mental illness, a charismatic, crazy person, that's another Hollywood trope. That's another thing that you see over and over again.
Well, paranoid schizophrenia in many movies, but definitely this one is like having an alter ego, almost a superhero character, the guy who's the up one, who's going to achieve anything, who's going to conquer the world, who's going to stand on a bridge and say, Stingo, my friend, is going to be the next great novelist, or being a drug addict.
And he is a drug addict, too. They say he has a cocaine problem.
Right, that's true. I meant in the sense of you can be really up, or of course you can be so far down. Or even just an alcoholic. You can be really up when you're drinking, but then you're hungover the next day if you drink too much. And that is a terrible feeling, as so many of us know.
Sophie, her attraction to Nathan seems totally obvious because, as she says to Stingo at some point, she needs to be distracted. She needs the drama. She needs something to live for that will completely consume her, whether it's positive or negative, or it's the charismatic side of him or the mean side of him. She just needs that to distract her. And when he's not around, she's always drinking. She needs to be numbed at all times, and that's part of what Nathan does for her.
And I think we said this already, but the masochism of when he does abuse her, we don't really see him slap her around, but it seems like he does do that.
He's cruel.
At the very least, he's cruel. When we first see them together in the hallway, when Stingo gets a look at them, he's right in her face and saying, what was it? Why didn't you die? How'd you survive? And what a terrible thing to say to somebody who didn't have the history that she does. But I think the movie makes it clear, without stomping on the point, not having Joseph Sommer tell us, that Nathan didn't know about the choice. The last word of the movie said by Joseph Sommer in voiceover is fair. And that's ironic considering almost nothing was fair in Sophie's life. They say it in the sense of she was fair-haired or she was a fair person. But I like the fact that the very last word is not appropriate, and I'm sure that was deliberate. That's a very writerly touch, actually. Mm-hmm. All right, Meryl Streep, we've seen her only once before, and this is it for her. Only two AFI films because she was in The Deer Hunter. We covered that only a few weeks ago. She's been in the business for nearly 40 years. Who doesn't know Meryl Streep? I don't need to go over her credits. Although, trivia question, what are her other two Oscar wins? This one and...
Oh, The Iron Lady.
Yep, and... Best Actress.
Damn it, is it Cry in the Dark?
Nope.
What is it?
Nominated for that, though. Her Supporting Actress win, which came before this as Best Actress, and then Iron Lady so many years later. Kramer versus Kramer.
Oh, of course.
This may not be the birth of it, but it's certainly the first example I can think of. Her signature mastery of foreign accents.
Yeah.
German and Polish, and obviously English, too, with that Polish accent. I don't know anything about the German or Polish languages, but apparently she speaks them just fine, or at least pretty well for an American in those flashback scenes.
She learned Polish just for this film, along with losing weight.
And looking bad a lot of the time, too.
Yes.
She looks glamorous in the 1947 scenes. She's never going to be the great beauty of Hollywood of all time, but she's an attractive woman, but she's never had to rely on just the looks.
Yeah, something I found a little disingenuous about the film is how they keep talking about how Sophie's a beautiful woman, and I'm not saying that Meryl Streep isn't a lovely-looking lady, but she was never a great beauty.
Susan Sarandon's a contemporary of hers who's also nice-looking, good-looking, but not a great Hollywood beauty.
Yeah, somebody that an SS officer would stop what he's doing and remark on how beautiful she is.
Mm-hmm. And when they cut her hair in the prison camps, and she probably has less makeup. Did you notice, too, that in the flashback sequences, the color's desaturated, much like Saving Private Ryan. That whole movie is desaturated, and they did the same thing in this film.
I didn't like that choice. Because the movie's supposed to take place, the current time is supposed to be 1947, and she's only flashing back to three years earlier, really, or maybe a little more than that. Mm-hmm. And when you take the color away that much, it wasn't just drabness, it was sepia-toned, it almost looked black and white. It implies that this was the distant past, whereas for Sophie, this isn't the distant past, this would still be very vibrant and clear to her.
Yeah, it isn't literally that far in the past, as we just said, and also for her, until the moment she dies, this is absolutely fresh in her mind. Well, as great as this performance is, a lot of other actresses could have had the role, or at least were in the talks for it, Barbara Streisand was in talks. Natalie Wood, Liv Ullmann, that would have been an interesting choice. She's the great Swedish actress who worked with Bergman so much. And then the writer of the book, William Styron, pictured Ursula Andress from the Bond movies. Oh. And I don't know much about her in other movies other than the Bond film. I think it was Dr. No she was in. I don't think she would have done anything close to as good as Meryl Streep did. Maybe none of those actresses would have, even Liv Ullmann.
Was she Polish?
Maybe.
She's praised for this being one of the greatest performances in Hollywood history, but I have seen some criticism of it. One of my favorite things was a critic called it the most perfect acting class exercise in history because she's so precise. Her accent is so well crafted. Her movements are so well crafted, but she doesn't necessarily embody the raw emotions, although I tend to disagree. I think the subtlety of her performance is truly breathtaking and beautiful and so full of depth.
Yeah, there's always going to be haters out there that just like somebody. I think that's what that is more than anything else, because I think it is a great performance. We saw two of the most famous performances of all time in the last few weeks or months. Raging Bull with De Niro would be another one that people still revere so much and point to as a touchstone. I want to do that and be like that. And then Meryl Streep in this film is another one. Well, her as an actual star in Hollywood, and she certainly has become that. She never really became a superstar blockbuster actress, although Mamma Mia made a lot of money not that long ago. But she's become the new Nicholson of the Oscar ceremony. It's her second home. Now, granted, she's almost always nominated, so she's going to be there anyway, but she's always got a prime place. Even when she's in a movie that didn't actually do all that well, The Iron Lady got a few nominations beyond her, but it wasn't a Best Picture nominee. It wasn't like she was amongst all of the people that made the film surrounded in the front, which is generally where people are going to be. But Nicholson hasn't been there in the last few years, and he was always there, even when his movie or himself weren't nominated for an award. He was the guy that Billy Crystal would go to for his jokes so often, and it was Jack, you know. I think that she's become the new Jack.
I agree, and I'm happy to see it. I just absolutely love her. I think that the only reason that Sophie's Choice is on the list at all is because she was underrepresented on the list. She's kind of like you've said about Spencer Tracy. She's a great actor. She's made lots of really good films. You might even say great films, but very few greatest films. Her performances are often the best thing in it, and I can't say that there is a true classic in her oeuvre.
Well, people might say The Deer Hunter or Kramer vs. Kramer, but those aren't really even her movies, so she's in them, but she's not the star of them. She's also in Adaptation, Nicolas Cage, one of his best performances.
Yeah, I knew you'd mention that. That's your favorite.
I love that. One of the best modern movies there's been. And certainly if there's another comedies list, and we should just redo that one anyway, Adaptation absolutely should make it. And she's funny in the film. It's not just Meryl Streep's in the movie playing Miss Actress. She's funny in that movie.
And I think even though it's far from a perfect movie, Devil Wears Prada, her performance in that is another great, iconic Meryl performance.
Well, I finally saw the movie. I didn't dislike it like I thought I would. Let's put it that way.
High praise.
Okay, her lover in the movie, Kevin Klein, his only AFI film. He was in A Fish Called Wanda, and then Dave is one of his best performances. I love him in that movie, playing two different characters, the president and the main character, Dave. It's one of his first movies, and what a great not-quite debut for him to make. He did The Big Chill the year after this, too, which is an ensemble piece, and then he was off and running from there. He hasn't really been in Hollywood the last many years because he and his wife, Phoebe Cates, everyone's beloved from the same year, Fast Times at Ridgemont High, her great pool scene that everyone loves so much. They got married quite a long time ago. He does make plenty of movies, usually independent kind of films, and he's now the professorial older gentleman role, often a supporting character. But he hasn't made a bona fide Hollywood film that often. Sometimes he does in maybe 20 years now because he wanted to do stage work and just character roles.
Yeah, he was an acclaimed theater actor before he did Sophie's Choice, so he wasn't coming from nowhere.
And then Peter McNichol is actually the star of the film, really. He's probably in the movie more than Streep and Klein are, but he is the weak link. It's only his second movie. The only other things that I think are all that notable for him, and he's done a lot of work, but Ghostbusters 2, where he plays one of the possessed villains, and then I've never seen the show, but Ally McBeal.
Yeah, he was the main Ally McBeal guy for, I think, the entirety of the series.
Mm-hmm. He is the encapsulation of something we've talked about plenty lately, a blank slate surrounded by interesting people. He's Luke Skywalker, even Dorothy from The Wizard of Oz, and then everyone else can be the fun, exciting, charismatic, that word again, characters in the picture. He's not bad in the movie. Maybe it would have been the exact same thing if they'd gotten a young Tom Cruise who was just coming up around the same time, or Sean Penn, or any of those other guys who were just becoming stars at the same time frame. Maybe it's the role more than the actor. But he does stand out as the weak link, if there is one in the film.
I'm forced to agree. I don't think he does necessarily a bad job, but there must be a real trick to being that perfect narrator, that cipher for the audience. And yeah, he comes up a little short.
The other actors I want to mention are the guy who played the commandant who almost rapes her. You can call it seduces in his mind anyway. He's also in Gandhi this same year, 1982, the Best Picture winner. And then David Wohl, who is the English teacher that she has when she first gets to America. He's also in Saving Private Ryan. He's been around a long time. He plays the Dean, I believe it is, in Revenge of the Nerds a few years after this movie. A whole different kind of movie than this one. The writer and director, Alan J. Pakula, 3 AFI films. This is the last one. He directed All the President's Men and produced To Kill a Mockingbird. All the President's Men and Sophie's Choice were additions to the list, and then Mockingbird made both of them, so he ended up having three films in total, one as a producer, which a lot of other great directors in the history of the business can't say. I wouldn't put him in that class of great directors, but he was apparently pretty well liked by the people that worked with him, maybe not so much William Goldman as the writer on All the President's Men. He budgeted for a long rehearsal on this movie, Sidney Lumet-esque, and then improvisation on the set. And he also has a theme that you see an awful lot of in either foreign directors or Jonathan Demme, who did Silence of the Lambs, where Meryl Streep especially looks right into the camera.
Yeah, when she's monologuing.
Confronting the audience. Yeah. The sequence with Stingo early on, when she talks about her experiences in the war, before she tells him her big secret about the choice, she looks into the camera quite a bit in that. And then Pakula did adapt Styron's novel. The producers were Pakula himself and Keith Barish, who went on to produce many movies, but these two are fun in particular. The Running Man and The Fugitive, which have nothing in common with Sophie's Choice. 1.85:1 print. The DVD is what we saw, and it is not a very good print, but the worst part about it is it's not anamorphic. We had to blow it up to fill the screen, so it looked even worse. And there's so many subtitles in the flashbacks, you could just barely read what was on the bottom line. It had to be blown up for us to see the picture without it being a tiny postage stamp on the TV. The cinematographer, Nestor Almendros, who worked with Streep quite a bit, including on Kramer vs. Kramer, and before that, Days of Heaven, which won an Oscar. That's the Terrence Malick film. The editor, Evan A. Lottman, was one of the many guys working on Apocalypse Now, and The Exorcist. Pretty good credits for him. Exorcist didn't make this list, though, and I've championed for it many times that it should have. Possibly a Not 100 Project movie next Halloween, although every movie, when we get to that point, will be a Not 100 Project film.
That's true.
The movie is dotted with flashback sequences, of course, primarily when she first tells Stingo what happened, and then when she tells him what really happened to her. And we get to enjoy two early montages within 45 seconds of each other. Every movie about the Holocaust needs a montage. I thought we were going to be in for a whole string of montages. But then, wasn't the music similar to what's in Butch Cassidy and Sundance Kid, where they have their montages, the three of them having fun and laughing?
Yeah, so tinkly and friendly.
Setting the stage for some dark stuff to come. And the composer that did some of that music, Marvin Hamlisch, he had previously worked on The Sting and The Way We Were, and he won three Oscars that year for those movies alone. He's a legend in the business. I'm sure he didn't love the score, though, but it was fairly low-key, as I recall.
Yeah, it didn't really make itself all that noticed. So.
Funny that this same year we had John Williams doing E.T., and we had Vangelis doing Blade Runner, and now this also nominated for the Oscar. Well, Vangelis wasn't, actually. And no one's going to ever think of the Hamlisch score as one of the great ones from that year. And then speaking of music, Beethoven's Ninth is in Sophie's Choice, and next week we cover Mozart. The whole movie is about him.
Yeah.
All right, there's a ton of influence. I already mentioned the almost famous connection that I made. The other two things to say are the 2002 opera. I could say this could be operatic, but I don't know about them singing.
There was an opera made of Sophie's Choice.
I saw that somewhere.
Well, that could be.
I had to make a choice.
You could say that was inspired by the book more than the movie, probably.
Mm-hmm. And then the term Sophie's Choice, about an impossible decision. That's been said in many contexts in movies and
it's
TV.
It's been cheapened many times over and over.
Not nearly as powerful or as meaningful as what's in this picture. Here's a very short section, the awards and AFI list. So it did win the Oscar for Streep for Best Actress. We talked on Tootsie how Jessica Lange didn't win for playing Frances Farmer so brilliantly. So she got the consolation prize of Best Supporting Actress for Tootsie, which we didn't think she should have won. Although she did win a Best Actress Oscar in 1994 for Blue Sky. But back to Sophie's Choice and its nominations. It did have four that didn't win for the script, the cinematography by Almendros, the costumes, and Hamlisch's music. This is rare, but it's not being preserved by Congress in the National Film Registry. Huh. And the only other nomination, and this is why I said at the top, this movie's not worthy of this list, it was nominated for the top 25 music scores and didn't make it. So no other AFI spots. Amadeus will have the same issue when we talk about that next week. Wrap it up for us, Bev.
I'll repeat that as much as we've been criticizing, I really did enjoy this film, and I would recommend it to anyone who's curious about it. But it's uneven, it's too long, there's nothing innovative about it.
We didn't talk about that. It's 2.5 hours. And the flashback sequences deserve their place. I don't think they drag it down. Maybe we see a few too many examples of Nathan nearly going off the edge, actually.
Yes. And I think that that first really long sequence where she's with the Commandant is too much.
Mm.
Goes on and on. It's quite likely that Pakula was just really married to the novel. Apparently he was extremely loyal to it, so he probably was afraid to mess with it too much. It doesn't work in that film narrative. The movie had no real cultural impact on top of the impact that the book already had. It's just really a capsule for a couple of great performances. In the last podcast, I suggested actors in the voting pool are probably the reason that Tootsie remains on the list. Well, I think that might be true here, too. Definitely. Voters are just bothered by Streep's underrepresentation. This is the film on the list that represents her phenomenal
career. I think you're onto something there. And isn't it curious that our four films in 1982, and let's talk about them now, E.T., Blade Runner, Tootsie, and Sophie's Choice. The last two, as you just said, actors would love those two. The first two are so influential. Even if you don't like Blade Runner and E.T., even if you say they're stupid or meaningless or badly made or whatever you might think about them, everybody who knows anything about movies knows about those films, knows what we're talking about when we say they're influential, maybe more so E.T.
Massive cultural impact, both of them.
Unlike these last two, the first two are not about acting at all. These other ones certainly are. Not that the performances are bad in E.T. We've raved about Henry Thomas and Drew Barrymore in particular in E.T. and Blade Runner's fine. Rutger Hauer actually is quite good in that film. But what an interesting year that was. It's one of the more diverse years in the entire list. And this is the last time we have this many movies in one year. And as we've said, the 80s has so few films in general, and four from one year alone.
And of 1982, all four of these movies, none of them won Best Picture. Mm-hmm. Gandhi won Best Picture.
Gandhi did not make the list either.
There
time,
you go for really bombing, again, Academy Awards. We talk about the Oscars a lot, and I do kind of love the Oscars, but damn, they really get it wrong a lot.
Well, it's a great comparison for the pinnacle of Hollywood. The AFI has a yearly show. They don't do these shows that we talk about anymore, but they do the one where they honor somebody, the AFI Lifetime Achievement Award. That means something. That means a lot, in fact, because you get an awful lot of people that have worked with the actor or the director who's being honored on that night to show up in the place or to just do a testimonial from wherever they are shooting a film, maybe on location. And that's a big deal. The Oscars, obviously, are a big deal, monetarily, if nothing else. That makes an awful lot of money for ABC and for the Academy. So no matter how bogus people might think either of them are, they are linked as far as prestige in Hollywood. And so often they've not been connected as far as making this list. Next week's film, Amadeus, and the one after that, Platoon, both won Best Picture.
Yeah.
And then after that, we've got a long string of Best Picture winners that make the list, and some of them right in a row in the 90s. And that's a good decade in general, both films I like, and also the AFI picks so many of those films that I like. But here in the 80s, you get this weird diversity, and you got so many years that didn't have any films that made the list at all. We didn't have anything from 83, we don't have anything from 87, yeah, or 88, or 85 for that matter.
So I know I probably don't even need to ask you what is your favorite of the four. Seems pretty obvious.
Well, it's E.T. without
a doubt. Head and Shoulders, the best movie of the four.
And I guess I said this on the other podcast. Blade Runner made the second list and not the first. That's true of Sophie's Choice also. Blade Runner should have made both of them for the influence alone.
Yes.
It doesn't need anything else. Sophie's Choice, no. Tootsie, I know why they put it on there. It was in the 60s both times. E.T. was about the same spot in the mid-20s, 24, 25. Tootsie making the list would be okay. It probably should be in the 90s, but I wouldn't put it on my list.
No, me neither. Blade Runner is a great film that I don't particularly like, but I think by any criteria, E.T. is just, by a country mile, the best of the four.
And it was definitely by far the highest ranked of these four. Okay, let's do something we've not done in a very long time, and I do mean a very long time, and that's open the email bag. A lot of this has been put on the site, but people maybe don't visit the website. They probably just download our podcast through iTunes. That's what I do with people's podcasts. I don't go to their websites either. Although, go to ours, www.top100project.com. There are things on there like trivia and reviews I've written and whatnot. So let's do some that have come up in the last few months.
All right, so our first email is from, and I might be saying this wrong, Oisin from Ireland.
Mm-hmm. Young man who's enjoying our podcast a lot. Said an awful lot of great things about us. We thank you for listening to us and being so complimentary. But one of the questions that came out of this was, have we seen The Trouble with Harry? Bev has not, correct?
No.
That is a Hitchcock film from the mid-50s. Did we like it? Well, I saw it. I wasn't a big fan. He was better at being winky funny, as he so often was in his movies, than LOL funny. And Trouble with Harry is supposed to be a bona fide comedy. It's not bad. It's just not anything great. And people don't generally talk about that with anywhere near the reverence they do his other pictures.
So Sheen is a massive Hitchcock fan, and he recommended Shadow of a Doubt to me, which I've never seen, and you saw it and seconded his recommendation.
So
that may wind up being a Not 100 in the future.
Apparently Hitchcock's favorite film of his own.
That's
been
right.
So many times. Okay, letter number two, Scott, who hated Sullivan's Travels way more than Bev did, actually.
Yeah.
And that's saying something. He had an awful lot to say about it. And if you want to read about it, go to the website and go to the Sullivan's Travels link, because that's where he wrote his little diatribe. The thing I'm going to mention right now is he thought the Sullivan character is narcissistic and that Veronica Lake's character added nothing. He also mentioned he wants to watch Swing Time just to see what we're talking about, see why it's so bad. But those are probably two Bev's crowning achievements with slamming movies, Swing Time and Sullivan's Travels. We own Sullivan's Travels. I bought it for $60+ a long time ago. Obviously, I like the movie enough to pay that much for a DVD. I didn't like it as much when I saw it again. I get why people like it, but that's the vanity thing. He talked about that in his post as well, that Hollywood, and we also said this in the podcast, they are in love with this movie because it justifies them to a huge extent. The movie's not nearly as funny as it needs to be revered this way, but the influence on Hollywood filmmakers, that's probably why it made it. We talked about influence of Blade Runner. It's true of Sullivan's Travels also.
I might hate Swing Time just for sheer stupidity of the film, but Sullivan's Travels has an ethically irresponsible message at its core that bothered me, and I just don't think it's okay.
Yeah. Jeff asked where you can find the 100 Years, 100 Movies shows. We always call them the top 100 list, but they're officially called AFI's 100 Years, 100 Movies. I bought a couple of discs worth of this stuff a long time ago. The actual show that was on TV, I recorded on videotape. And I got a friend to transfer the videotape to DVD for us about a year ago. And we've watched the second show since, because you'd never seen either of them. And we had seen the first one, because I had that on DVD at least. To answer the question for Jeff, I think I said this on the website already, but I don't know where you can find it. I hope you can, for your own sake. And if you're listening to this and you're a friend of ours and you want to see the original shows, we'll loan them to you. But obviously not to someone we don't even know.
Yeah, they're surprisingly hard to come by. But
it's copyright.
Okay, well, that makes total sense. But in fairness, they're really not all that.
No. If you just go on Wikipedia, the AFI website itself, which we always link on every single podcast, and look at the list, that's probably enough. And if you want to see the movie, watch the movie based on the fact that you're interested in it. The show doesn't really add to it. Way too many people, including Susan Lucci, has some points to make on the first show, but I love that movie. Why have people saying that? Say why you love the movie.
It's just hyperbolic praise with the occasional insight that is nothing compared to what you could find. Read Roger Ebert's review.
Except on Tootsie, when we talked about that last week. They spent a lot of time for a movie that's in the 60s. That movie got a lot of focus, and Dustin Hoffman in particular talking about it. And we did include a link on the website last week.
If you want insight into the top 100 list, I think you've already come to the right place.
Well, of course. That's the main thing anyway. All right, so the last message was from Grant. He's a longtime listener and fan. We thank him once again for listening to us. This is more of just a comment than a question. He ragged on me in the Clerks podcast about Clerks 2, which I said was a pretty decent follow-up. I've grown to like it more than when I first saw it, which I thought was fine then, too. He apparently hates it. I think he thinks of it as our friend Carl thinks of Indiana Jones Part 4, which to Carl doesn't even exist. But when he listened to our podcast about Clerks, it made him want to see that movie all over again, so at least we helped promote that movie for him. And that was picked by the Pick Your Podcast winner when we had the contest. Trevor, maybe we'll do a contest again in some kind of way before this is all said and done. But we're almost to the end. We only got, I think it's 17 more now to go. 123 total.
It's incredible.
And this was 106. All right, let's close that mailbag. Shout out to David Letterman. Happy retirement, Dave. Okay, up next on the Top 100 Project is Milos Forman's final AFI film. It's the Mozart drama, Amadeus. The coming attractions trivia for Amadeus. This is really easy to find. We just talked about the AFI's website or even Wikipedia. So if you want to know this one, it is going to be simple. What are the three movies that ranked higher than Amadeus on the 1998 AFI Top 100 and then, like Amadeus, missed the cut in 2007?
Okay, so for the answer to that question, please tune into next week's podcast. If you'd like more trivia from Ron and me, along with all kinds of other fun stuff, including links to some of the things that we talked about in today's podcast, please visit our website, top100project.com, where you can also leave comments that might wind up in a future podcast.
Many months later, probably.
Yes. And if you'd like to reach us directly and send us a private message, our email is top100projectpodcast@gmail.com. Don't forget to subscribe to the Top 100 Project on iTunes, and don't forget that in iTunes is our entire back catalog, which now includes over 100 podcasts about all these great films that we talk about. So go ahead and dig in and check out everything that we have to say.
Some great beach listening as we get into the summer months.
Yeah, that's right. It's summertime. You need something to put in your iPod while you're chilling on the beach. This is it. And before we go, we have to warmly thank our sponsor, SparkPlugCoffee.com.
Which you probably won't want to be drinking on the beach when it's 30 degrees.
You know, you can make iced coffee, I do believe. Okay. You can easily find a great recipe online for cold brew coffee.
Then go to the sponsor and find out about this.
Some of us don't let heat get in between us and our coffee.
Oh, okay. All right. All right, well, I suggest at the top of this podcast, you might choose the dogs over your husband. You've been put to the test. Choose now!
I can't choose now,
or I kill them both!
Okay, take my husband!
I knew it.
And cut.